Hello everyone and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management Weekly News Roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rod Jones, Content Manager at the Institute, and in this first podcast of the new decade, we will be looking at news up to the 6th of January 2020. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute.
Hello Rod and Happy New Year to you.
Hello Kate. And a Happy New Year to you. Our first story is that the UK has fallen 6 places down the global rankings for gender equality. Despite successive prime ministers pledging to take decisive action to tackle the gender imbalances in politics and wider British society, the UK has dropped from the 15th most equal nation in the world to 21st. The Guardian Online reports that the World Economic Forum said Albania, Canada, Costa Rica, Latvia, Switzerland, South Africa and Spain had all leapfrogged the UK in closing the gender gap across politics, economics, health and education since the last audit in 2018. The WEF, which organises the annual meeting of politicians and business leaders in Davos, Switzerland, said so little progress had been made in tackling the problem that it would take 100 years to close the global gender gap. This year's report highlights the growing urgency for action, said Klaus Schwab, the founder and executive chairman of the WEF. Without the equal inclusion of half of the world's talent, we will not be able to deliver on the promise of the fourth industrial revolution for all society, grow our economies for greater shared prosperity, or achieve the UN sustainable developmental goals. Kate, what more can leaders do to tackle gender imbalances in their organisations?
Well, Rod, much as I like these big statements, sweeping statements, urgent action is required, and you know, we will not achieve the rates of growth globally without the inclusion of women. It's not those sorts of statements that's going to change anything. It's the everyday actions of managers, of HR professionals who are making decisions to shortlist, to promote. And as we've seen from some research published by HBR about what they're terming schmoozing, the use of conversation in organisations, because it's conversation that influences these decisions, receives insufficient attention. And as Deborah Tannen highlights so frequently, men and women use conversation differently. And until we really understand that and make decisions on objective criteria, which take into account this, as I say, HBR are calling schmoozing, we're not going to close the gender pay gap.
Right, thank you, Kate. This probably takes us on well to the next story, which is taken from the Harvard Business Review and asks, why don't women self-promote as much as men? This research by Christine Exley and Judd Kessler sees self-promotion as a pervasive part of work, with more self-promotion perhaps improving your chances of being hired, being promoted and getting a raise or a bonus. As research is interested in gender gaps in earnings, negotiations and leadership, they wanted to find whether gender differences in self-promotion also exist and might contribute to those gaps. Their research found a large gender gap in self-promotion, with men rating their performance 33% higher than equally performing women. To understand what was driving this gap, they looked at two factors that might influence one's level of self-promotion, that is confidence and strategic incentives. In every setting they explored, they observed a substantial gender gap in self-promotion. Women systematically provided less favourable assessments of their own past performance and potential future ability than equally performing men. And our various study versions revealed that this gender gap was not driven by confidence, you may be unsure of your actual performance, or by strategic incentives, you may talk up your performance to get a raise or promotion, and that it was robust both in the face of ambiguity and under increased transparency. The researchers could only speculate on the cause of gender gap in self-promotion and conclude that there is more research to be done. Kate, what lesson should leaders take from this research?
Well, I'd always be surprised if researchers didn't conclude with the statement that more research needs to be done in this area. And it's not as though they're uncovering something that we're not already aware of. But I think we look at this the wrong way round. rather than asking why do women underpromote themselves, why aren't we asking why do men overpromote themselves? If we take the norm as the level of confidence that women express, then the question to ask is why are men overconfident? So it's not that women need to go on confidence deficit training. It's perhaps we need to look at the language that we use in order to make promotion decisions. But I think the best thing about research like this is making us aware of these gender imbalances. And it's so much more than equal pay for equal work. And that is really what I hope people will start addressing in 2020, these inbuilt, unconscious biases in how we run our organisations.
Thank you, Kate. Our next story is taken from The Conversation and looks at how the history of the two-day weekend offers lessons for today's calls for a four-day week. In this article, Brad Bevan, Professor of Social and Cultural History, University of Portsmouth, argues that there are a number of parallels between debates today about reducing the working week from an average of 5 days to four and those debates that took place in the 19th century when the weekend as we now know it was first introduced. He points out that having Saturdays as well as Sundays off work is actually a relatively modern phenomenon, but the weekend did not simply arise from government legislation. It was shaped by a combination of campaigns. Some were led by half-day holiday movements, others by trades unions, commercial leisure companies and employers themselves. This laid the groundwork for the full 48-hour weekend as we know it, although this was only established in the 1930s. Once again, it was embraced by employers who found that the full Saturday and Sunday break reduced absenteeism and actually improved efficiency. Kate, what more can be done to persuade organisations to switch to fewer but more productive hours in the working week?
Essentially, if we look at history, as you've been suggesting, the working week is going to reduce if the trend continues, and that would certainly seem to be the case. But with the way we're operating more internationally, globally, with technology able to assist remote working, it might not be a three-day weekend as we have come to know Saturday and Sunday, because of course that has changed quite radically for many people because of Sunday opening. Many leisure activities are open all the time. So we will be moving towards a shorter working week in hours, but not necessarily that we're all knocking off on Thursday rather than Friday at 9 o'clock. I think it's interesting, these claims for improved efficiency, and we still don't know from the companies that have adopted the four-day week how sustainable these are and what becomes the new normal. Is it as efficient and exciting as it is the day that you all went down from 5 to 4 days a week? So 2020, absolutely the time to watch this space.
Excellent. Thank you, Kate. Our final story is an article by John Anderer from Study Finds that suggests flirting with co-workers can help reduce stress. This is taken from a publication in the scientific journal Organisational Behaviour and Human Decision Processes, and the authors are very quick to point out there is a serious difference between harmless banter between colleagues and the acts of sexual harassment that were so often perpetrated by those in positions of power for decades. According to Washington State University Assistant Professor Leah Shepherd, while being subjected to constant and deliberate acts of sexual harassment causes significant stress, being the recipient of some playful flirting can actually do the opposite. Additionally, in a move that is sure to incite at least a little controversy, the study's authors openly speculate if recent zero-tolerance policies regarding sexual behaviour among co-workers are attempting to police employee interactions too thoroughly. Examples of such policies include Netflix's 5-second stare limit for looking at fellow employees and NBC's recent rule prohibiting co-workers from sharing cabs together. Kate, would you agree with Professor Shepherd that managers in today's day and age should strive to find a balance in the offices they manage in which they avoid instituting overly restrictive behaviour policies but also avoid engaging in any social sexual behaviour themselves?
I'm very slow to condemn Netflix or NBC, because by setting a very high standard for behaviour, it enables most of the rest of us to set a standard that's a bit short of that, but at least the extreme has been identified. So we know from this that staring at somebody can be uncomfortable for the recipient of scare. We also know that taxis are close and confined intimate spaces that some people might feel uncomfortable sharing that space with somebody who they feel has sexual intentions towards them. So well done to them for articulating it for us. And it's a bit like extreme health and safety concerns, that it enables us to talk about what's reasonable, what's acceptable. And it's a bit like extreme health and safety concerns. It's by talking about the absolute worst case scenario that enables us to get the optimum, or the place that's good enough for most of the people most of the time.
Thank you, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rod.